Yeah, my name's Dennis and I'm an alcoholic. First, I'd like to welcome the newcomers, anybody that's new in here. I have 10 minutes, so you know, I can't really get into a whole lot of stuff. But my allergies are acting up a little bit. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, if I'm not only allergic to alcohol too, you know. But I'm grateful to be here. You know, my wife told me last night, she said, you know, I'm going to be speaking in Tulare tomorrow, she said. So I said, okay, I'll be ready, you know. And then she said, by the way, you're the warm-up speaker. Okay, thank you, you know. But you know what, it's an honor, you know. I was thinking about what I was going to say, you know, I had a bunch of stuff and now it's all gone, but you know what, I want to share a little bit, since I have 10 minutes, you know, about how I met my wife, you know. First of all, I'm glad that I'm on here before her, because going after her is like going after the Rolling Stones, you know. You don't want to go after the Rolling Stones, you know. Anyways, we were having dinner tonight, and I came up and I thought, well, you know, I think I'm going to talk about how I met her, you know. I met her at a Clean and Sober AA dance at St. John's Cathedral in Fresno. I had 18 months, I remember that, because that's what I told her, you know. I had just gotten sober for a little while, 18 months, but as soon as I got sober, it was like, what am I going to do now, you know, it's like, I'm sober now, what am I going to do, you know, and the first thing that popped into my head was, I want a motorcycle. You know, I had a motorcycle years before when I was in my 20s, you know, and I sold it for drugs, you know, but anyways, I couldn't ride it anyway, so I kept on falling over, you know. So I went for a long time without a motorcycle, you know. And so as soon as I got sober, it was like, okay, that's what I want, you know. And I was living with my mom at the time, and I told my mom, I said, you know what, I'm going to get a motorcycle, you know. So I'm going to, you know, cut down a little, I was giving her rent, you know, helping her, with this. I said, I might cut back a little. She goes, that's fine. She was just happy that I was sober and clean. And that I was going to do something that I wanted to do. So anyways, I had this motorcycle built for me, you know, a custom show bike, all this stuff, you know, all this money in it. You know, and I go to this AA dance, you know, and wearing a Hardy hat, you know, a cap, you know. And I'm standing against the wall, because that's what I was used to doing, you know. Nobody in back of me, I didn't want nobody walking around behind me or nothing, you know. I was still like that, you know. You know, and so I was standing there like that, and I looked to the side, and there was this pretty girl sitting there on the chairs, you know, these chairs that were there, you know, and I looked and I go, wow, that's a pretty girl there, you know, and I thought, wow, you know, there's no way I could, you know, shouldn't have anything to do with me, you know, so I'm standing there, and then the guy goes up and asks her to dance, you know, and then she says no, you know. And I'm standing there, and then another guy went and asked her to dance, and she says no. You know, and I don't know what happened. I don't know how it happened. I ended up walking over there. I didn't walk over there. I don't know. I guess it was that. I know. And then I go, you want to dance? You know, and then I started walking away because I figured you'd say no. And then I hear a little voice. Yes. Huh? Yes. Oh, okay, let's go, you know. So I took her out there to dance, you know, and it was a slow song, slow dance. So I'm dancing with her like this. You you know, and, and then I tell her, I go, hey, I have a Harley. And then she goes, I don't give a shit, I don't even like that. So I go, oh, okay, okay. So I'm thinking, well, what do I say next? And the program kicks in. I have 18 months, clean and sober, and I have a sponsor and I work the steps. Oh, okay, that, you know, perked her up a little bit, and, you know, and then I asked her for her phone number. Can I have your phone number? And she goes, wait a minute. She was with another girl there. She goes, wait a minute. I gotta go talk to her. And then she took off, and I go, well, I guess, you know, whatever. So I'm standing there, and she comes back, and then she says, you know, I will give you my number, but you give me your number. So I said, yeah, okay, sure. And I thought, yeah, that was a nice way of letting me, you know, letting me down, you know. So she's never going to call me, you know. She's never going to call or anything, you know. And 2 weeks later, she calls. My mom asked me, there's some girl on the phone. And I said, girl? And I said, hello? I didn't know who she was. She said, come look, you remember I met you? I said, oh! You know, so we ended up going out there and I picked her up on the bike, and I can't get into a whole long story because the time's up, but we ended up, I taken her on the bike on a date. I put a big bubble helmet on her, you know? And she gets on, and to make the long story short, now she wears a bandana, she has her boots on, and she stands there like that, and let's go. She wants her own bike. But anyways, I thought I would tell that story because, you know, this program, I want to close with this, you know, this program not only helped me to stay sober and clean, but it's given me a life, you know. She's got a wonderful woman like Lupi, you know. A lot of you people know her, and you'll see when you hear her talk, what I'm talking about. She's a blessing. She's gifted. She's blessed. Like God put his rays on her, double, you know. No, thank you.
Okay, at this
my name's Lupe and I am an alcoholic. Hi. I haven't felt like this in a long time. I think it's because I'm back home. There's a difference when you're out of town and you come back home. You know, there's just so many familiar faces in here that mean so much to me, that I've had a part in my recovery when I first walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. God, like my emotions just went across. Everybody knows I'm a crybaby, but golly, you know, I want to get all crazy, you know. No, I'm just kidding. Well, this has been a journey, you know. It was like, when my life began, it was a journey to become an alcoholic. You know, I don't think it was something that was intended, but I come from an alcoholic family. And I was given my first dose of alcohol from family members. And little did I know that I had this disease, and it woke up a monster that just wanted to eat me up and chew me up and spit me out. In that journey, a lot of things happened. You know, I come from a place where I belonged, and I believed I belonged, and it was a small town. Well, not really a small town, but I felt it was a small town because it was a small barrio, you know. And if you didn't live there, then you know, I guess that's where I learned that character defect of being territorial, you know, and color really made a difference in the way that you lived and the things that you believed in meant a difference. And so anytime that I left this little area, this barrio, you know, there was trouble. And I never was alone. You know, I had my family. Well, anyways, my alcoholism, I think my drinking started once the seed was planted with that little seed of that alcohol, that drink, you know, with the help of, I was child molested, and the only way that I knew that took away feelings was beer. And I remembered exactly what that felt like because, like I said, my family gave me my first taste. And so I went straight to my mom's refrigerator, and that's all we really had in there other than bread. So I popped open my first whole can of Olympia, and then my journey began. It did something to me. I liked what it did, and it continued to work. You know, I want to get through my whole history, but there's just not enough time. You know, so I'm going to be jumping back and forth. But I believe my God's going to give me the message from my heart that I feel that I need to give you about me. My mom was she was an alcoholic, and so was my dad. My dad was a drug addict, and so was my mother. And my mom was also suicidal. And when this happened to me, I couldn't cope with the fact that when I saw my mom on the bed, laying on the side of the bed with a big, in those days, I mean, I was 5 years old, so the bottle of aspirin seemed so big, you know, that when I seen that toss from the floor and the aspirins all over my mom hanging on the side of the bed, it scared me, you know. That kind of like double whammed me, you know, and the only thing I could think of, which was taught to me at a young age, was dial zero. And I dialed zero, and I tried my best to explain what had happened. And that's when they came, and the police came, and they found that I was intoxicated. And they took me away from my mother. Because my mom was incapable of caring for me, because she was suicidal, and she was drunk. And not only did she take aspirin, but she also had cut her wrist, and so she didn't have the ability to care for me, you know. During this time, you know, just a lot of drama like that, you know, for years. A lot of domestic violence, a lot of drinking. I hope nobody minds that I talk about the drugs, because that's also part of my history, because we were, we used everything. You know, but we call ourselves like garbage pails, you know. Anything that came to get us loaded, we take it all, you know. But yeah, so that's where I come from. My father, he was a drug dealer, very abusive to my mother and my oldest brother, and very, he used to go out with other women. So there was a lot of dysfunction, you know, in our family. I always felt that I was the favorite one because I never was the one that physically got abused by my father, but I always did get abused by my mother, you know, but I was my dad's favorite, so any time that my mom would ever lay hands on me, you know, I would always run to my daddy, and my daddy would rescue me and teach my mom a lesson, you know, and I found out in this time, you know, that my dad never really wanted me to continue practicing drinking or drugging, but because my dad had left my mom and ended up with another woman, you know, in San Bernardino, you know, and then I was over here in our small little barrio, you know, my mom cared for me, and she had built some resentment toward me because I was close to my father. I have a little brother. He's my little brother, and I always be my little brother, and I love my little brother, and he is my special brother, and I'm going to get to him in a little while. But you know, there was just so much stuff that was going on, and the alcohol and the drinking, you know, really interfered with my schooling, and it really interfered with my relations, and it really introduced me to a way of life of survival, you know, because I had to learn to survive in the lifestyle that I was brought up in, because there was so much stuff, you know, that was happening, and I had to keep drowning my sorrows, you know, and getting drunk and not wanting to come to a state of coming to, because I knew that there was just a lot of feelings I couldn't deal with, you know. And I took it to school, and everything that I took to school, I took it out on others, and it got me in a lot of trouble, you know. And we were very poor, you know, so it's that old saying, what was yours was mine, and what was mine, you know, and if I didn't have it, I was going to take it. You know, and when you were on vacation, I was the one that was crawling in your windows, and I was the one that was sleeping on your bed when you were gone. You know, if you were missing something, it was probably in my house, you know. But that's what I was taught. You know, that's how I lived. My mom taught us a lot of those behaviors, you know, because we were survivors. You know, we lived off of welfare. My mom did what she had to do, you know. Then my baby brother came. You know, I mean, you know, when my husband was talking about bikers, I had resentment toward bikers for years. Years, and I thought it was years to come, you know. And my mom was the kind of person which I learned, you know, that she can become anything she wanted at any time. Alcohol made us do things that we would not normally do, you know. And my mom was a biker, and she was a pachuca, and she was this, and she was that, and you know what? And I learned how to be that, you know, so. But anyways, my little brother was born, and it's a small town, so, I mean, somebody can yell across the whole neighborhood, and everybody knows the news, and I'm sure that some of you should say to that, you know, so everybody knew my mom had my little brother, and where was his dad, you know? And one thing about my dad, and I think those are the things that later on you're going to find out that I think that was instilled in me when we take away the drinking and the using of drugs, who I really am. My dad was a very hard worker. He had a good heart, and he had a lot of compassion. And when my brother was born, since his father really didn't want anything to do with him, my father gave my brother his name. He did not want my mom to be talked about. And my brother became my brother. And because he was brought into the same world that I was brought up in, it got really rough. He was this kid. You know, not only was I drinking and doing what I was doing to cope with whatever I had to do, you know, I had to continue to do what I was doing to cope with a kid like that was hyperactive, you know. And, I mean, we had issues because he was my baby brother and I was the only one home, and he was by me all the time, and it was like I could never get rid of him, you know. But this is when Batman and Robin came around, and he threw a blanket over. He was driving me insane, you know. And it was like the more that he was by me, the more I'd want to go get loaded. And I was drinking all the time. But one of the things that I do know is that I always had him with me. And I tried my best to be the parent I wasn't, you know. And I influenced my brother, or exposed my brothers to things that parents wouldn't normally expose their children to. You know, so my brother, you know, went through a lot with me, and there was a lot of things that I did to my brother that was taught to me. When you punish your children, this is what you do. And so my brother really suffered a lot of what I was taught, you know, and I raised him to the best of my ability at the time, you know, and it wasn't good parenting skills. You know, my mom had no parenting skills, and my dad didn't have no parenting skills. You know, we were just a bunch of drunks and trying to get along, and a lot of prejudiceness, and and trying to fit into the world and blaming everybody, you know, about what was going on in our lives. And is this ever going to get better? I was told no, you know. But the system seemed something different. 9 years old was my first event of being in the system. And when I was nine, that's when I was taught what the system was about. And I thought it was a big deal, you know, when I got involved with the system. And I wanted to continue, because I have an older brother I don't want to leave out, because he was a big influence on me at the very beginning. I wanted to be like him. He was my teacher when it came to learning certain survival tools. And I wanted to go to the pen like him. I wanted to go to camp like him. I wanted, you know, to hang out like him. You know, I wanted to cruise around and drink like him. You know, I wanted to talk like him. If I could, I would have wanted to look like him. You know, and I wanted everything like him, because he was making it. You know, he wasn't going through what we were going through, because he was being taken care of. You know, he was being taken care of by certain people that he didn't have to worry about anything. So I wanted to be like that too, you know. So I started being taken care of myself, just like him, you know. But little did I know what was coming, you know, with all that. I didn't know, you know, what kind of things these people would do. So I was introduced to things that led me to go through the system and experience there, I can't say bars, because there's no bars. There were dormitories, you know. I remember one time when me and my brother got locked up together, and it was a big deal, you know, because we were having breakfast together, we were having lunch together, we were having dinner together, and we were throwing kites together and catching the kites along. But he was my cousin, you know. He was my brother. He was something big. Now I became big. See, now I got my first tattoo, and now I was moving up the ladder, and now I could get loaded just like everybody else, you know. I could drink you underneath the table, you know. I could do what you can do now, you know, because I got that false courage, you know. But nobody really knew what was going on inside of me, you know. And so a lot of what I was doing was pretending, you know. So I stepped up, you know. I stepped up and I owned and I did, me and my brother were known, and I felt proud. And then when my brother ended up in prison, you know, I wanted to be there too, you know. And in between this time that I'm wanting to be this way, I used to say my life was like Sybil, and I don't know if anybody understands that, but my life was like Sybil, because I have another part of my family that, there was etiquette, there was dressing nice, there was like sitting at a dinner table, having dinner together, going to the Catholic Church, going to catechism, you know. There was like celebrating Easter, you know, and things like that, and my hair up in curls with socks, lacy socks with patent leather shoes and pleated skirts, and it was like, that's how I would dress with this family, you know, which they would have their glass of wine. They didn't ever drink beer. They drank wine, you know. And then I had my grandfather, who was a wino, Native American, so I go and drink my wine. So I learned to drink wine now, not just beer, but wine, you know. And so it's like when I go with this family, all my body of clothes would go in a bag, go in the closet, and then I'd go with this family, then everything would come out of the closet, then I'd put things back in the closet, and then I'd get the things out of the bag and go home, you know, and to my mom. So that's the way it was for a long time, back and forth, until the system deal happened over and over and over and over again, you know. public intoxication, being under the influence, drug dealing, and, you know, I don't, to tell you the truth, I don't remember very much of public school. I did a lot of my school in juvenile hall. So I didn't get the privilege, you know. I remember one time coming out and going to the school called Sequoia Junior High, and I was dealing to make some money for the family, and I got in trouble and didn't last very long. But I'm going to put in a little bit about the good things about me, because in between here, in the time of my drinking and my using, there's certain positive qualities that I had during that time that I did make attempts, you know, to do something different or to be different than the vario kind of life and the other kind of life, you know. I was trying to be like all some of the other kids, you know. When I was in kindergarten, you know, I remember my kindergarten teacher got me involved in gymnastics. And I started gymnastics, you know, the tumbling and stuff. And this was before I got started drinking, you know. And I was doing really good in gymnastics, you know. And until I got a hold of that, you know, my drinking, you know, when the drinking started, and then that started deteriorating. But I still continued. I still continued to do the gymnastics. And then I got older and I touched a little bit on the violin and a little bit on the clarinet. And I tried to... you know, I was really an athlete, you know. I loved track, swimming, softball, you know. But because of my alcoholism and because of the, I couldn't stop drinking. I drank all the time. I was drunk. I couldn't stop drinking. It was like, it became a part of my blood system. It was like I couldn't function without drinking. You know, everything else that, like the drugs and stuff, always came afterwards. The drink is my primary, you know, my primary problem, alcohol. And all those things that I tried to accomplish didn't work. I just could never succeed. I always got disqualified. I remember I always wanted that sweater, you know, like everybody used to wear with a letter on it, you know. And they used to have the hat, the ball, and I worked really hard for that, and I made it, you know. I made it as far as the plastic bag, you know, but I never made it to actually, except for the swimmer I did, you know. The swimmer, you know, I actually got the swimmer put on my sweater, and I felt like I was accomplishing something, you know. And then until I got on the diving board, and I did a 1.5 on the board, and I hit my leg on the board, and it knocked me out. And it was because I had been on paint. I had sniffed some paint and knocked me out, you know, and so I got disqualified, you know. And they ripped that thing right off of my sweater, you know. And these are things where, and the more and more I experience this stuff, not just at school, you know, but trying to fit in with my other kind of family, and then trying to be like my brother, and trying to be the mother, and trying to do all these other things, you know, it just got worse, you know. So the last time that I got in trouble, I didn't have a choice. I did some time, and I had run away. They had gave me a chance. I went to a group home. And because I had been to a lot of foster homes, I could never find my stable place. I think in 7 years, my probation officer said I had been in 21 homes, and she was tired of chasing me, you know. She was tired of spending money on airplane tickets, and, you know, and tired of picking me up and taking me and then me running, you know. So the last time, it was a traumatic event, not just for me, but for my baby brother, you know, and that was Albert, you know. Albert's my baby brother. And and I remember that last little journey for us. It was really hard for me because I was on felony probation, and we were shining shoes. You know, my grandmother was very... she didn't want anything to do with my baby brother because, as far as she was concerned, he wasn't family. So I had to help support him. because he had just gotten abandoned in Belmont by his godfather. And I came home one day and it was an empty house. And I had to find a place for us to live. So the only one that I could depend on was my grandmother, and I had to support my brother, so we became shoe shiners. And so I shined shoes, and we became her slaves, you know. We just did whatever we had to just to live in her house. And we didn't even live in her house. We slept in the patio, you know. And she put some bunk beds out there, and we lived out there for a long time. You know, our mother abandoned us. We didn't know where my mom was. She was trying to find herself somewhere, you know, drinking her juice. And so it was like, you know, we just, it was just a real difficult life for us, you know. But I had to leave because I was being, and my grandmother had called. It was a real awful day that day. And, you know, I went and got a beer, and I was shining shoes, and my brother, you know, he was shining shoes. We used to kneel down on pavement. We should have started off on these little boxes, you know, those little travel boxes, you know, with the shoe shine, you know, and we'd get on the pavement. We used to shine, we used to go to truck stops, and we used to shine boots, and, you know, and, oh, God, it was a rough job. And but anyways, my grandmother had gotten upset one day and said that, that I was taking the money. It was pouring rain, but she said I was taking the money, and she called my probation officer, and I couldn't stick around. I wasn't going to stick around, you know, and go back and get locked up again. So I know that Albert was there, and I wanted to take him with me, and I had to leave him there, you know. And the only thing I can think of telling him is, you go to school tomorrow, you tell him that Grandma just beat your butt so bad so they can get you out of there. And the reason why is because she was beating him, you know, and she was, and she just was a real mean woman, you know. And my grandpa was too drunk to protect us, you know, because my grandpa was alcoholic too. But anyways, I left my brother, you know, and I went on the run, and so when I went on the run, you know, that was the last thing that they could do for me. She picked me up from Las Cruces to Mexico and said, this is it for you. It's either you stay here or you go back. You don't got a choice no more. You're ready. I remember my mom came to court one time, and she was so drunk. She just got back from partying, and she comes, and the judge, I have an uncle, and I have my mom, and then my mom says, well, you know what, she's hard to handle, and I don't want her here, and I can't handle her, and I don't know what you're going to do with it, but I don't want her at home, you know, and started yelling. And then I have my aunt and my uncle saying, well, we'll take her, and we'll send her to college, and we'll just build another room to our house, and we'll just care for her. And I didn't want to go with neither one of them. I felt one was not good enough for me, and the other one was trying to buy me. So it was like, you know what, I'd rather be in the system. And the judge told me, you know, now you're going to be raised by the worst parent in the world. You're 13 years old, and you've made a decision. And he was right. He was right, you know. And so when my probation officer picked me up from Las Cruces, New Mexico, I really believed this was a family for me. It was a truck driver. He was Native American, and he told me, look, Lucy, you really got to stop doing what you're doing, you know. And I know if you ever want to have a family, I know somebody who will take you in. And I remembered that when I ran, and I went to the truck stop, only one truck stop closest to where my grandmother lived. So I went to this truck stop, and I looked for his truck. I knew what kind of truck and the trailer he had, and I was looking, and I was going to wait until I found him, and it was like, there he was, you know. And he didn't give me a ride because he said I was too old to give, that for him to give me a ride because I was too tempting for him, that he would pay my way better. And he put me on the bus and sent me to Las Cruces, New Mexico. Didn't last very long. You know, my drinking, it just didn't permit me to do anything. You know, this was a good family. You know, they were a very nice family. But my drinking, it just wouldn't allow me to be a family member. You know, I just couldn't be their child, and I couldn't sit still, and they couldn't control me, you know, and I missed home. I missed the drama, you know, so they found where I was because I called back home, and they came and picked me up, and they brought me back, and that's when she said, I don't got no more homes for you. At 13 years old, they don't have homes for you. You know, and especially if you burn so many bridges and you're an alcoholic and a drug addict, there's not too many homes for you, you know. And so when I got into a home, you know, her name's Margaret. I don't even know if she's alive, but I know that that I wanted to thank her for her willingness to help me. But she was the last home, and I stayed there, and I turned 18, and then I felt like I was kicked to the curb, because foster homes in those times, you just go with a certain amount of clothes with no money, you know, and you got to fend for yourself. You know, it's not like today, you know, which I'm grateful that foster kids today get programs and they're, you know, they get schools and stuff. I'm glad that they finally started doing things like that. But anyways, my alcoholism just got worse. It just progressed to get worse, and my drugging and my characteristics just got worse. It just kept me getting really bad. And when I was locked up, I had seen a psychiatrist, and there was a situation where my mom had pressed charges on me because I did this with my sponsor on my inventory. I'm not afraid to share it now, you know, but my mom, you know, she had pressed charges on me because one time I got upset because we were eating the welfare scrambled eggs and there were some roaches in there, so I was with the fork yelling at her, and the fork slipped out of my hand. Now, did I do it intentionally? You know, that was the question, you know, and the fork stuck her, you know, and so she charged me with it, and, you know, she pressed charges on me, you know, and so, you know, there's things like that to where, you know, I had to put up with. So when I left the group home, when I left my lost foster home, I had to go back with this woman. And the psychiatrist that told me there was going to be a time in my life where I was going to miss my mother, because she's my mother. And that I was going to want to get back with my mother. I don't mean to offend anybody, but I despise my mother. I despise her with a passion. She was unable to protect me. She could never mother me. She could never teach me. She never protected me. And I despise her for that. And this person tells me that there's going to be a day where I was going to be able to go back to my mother, and it came. Little did I know that things had not changed. Things were the same. It was the same. It was like it never left. It was like the world stood still, and things, the story just was the same. And I came back, and if you come from where I come from, you just never leave your family, you know. And so I had a price to pay from leaving my family, and I have some scars from it. And the thing is that the scars continued. It was so much abuse and so much not being able to forgive. My brother shares it in this way. It just brings laughter, you know. But to me, I still feel at times the pain. You know that we make up, and then here we are doing it again, you know. And we're drinking to resolve the pain. We don't want to feel the pain, so we drink to make up, you know. And then we drink to fight, And then we come to, and there we are again, you know. So it's like a family that could never wake up to a settled life, you know. And my mom and all of us are still dealing with the same old things from years back, you know. So if that continued, and there was no way out because, like I say, I come from a life where it's very territorial. So nobody leaves the family. We have one person who took the place of my dad after my dad got shot and killed. And that was my big brother, so we could never leave the family. It was like he was the boss, and he was the one that said, you can go now, and you can come back home now. You know, so it was like we could never do anything different. Okay, we can drink now, we can make it up now, you know, and it was always the same scenario, you know. But anyways, that just continued, you know. You know, the program talks about three bottoms, and I never forget this because I heard it a lot when I was in treatment, you know, and my journey ended, you know, I think, I'm not going to say think because that's not going to be the truth, but I believe that my bottom happened at a spiritual bottom. You know, I have two children who were exposed babies. I didn't know how to mother. Well, I didn't know how to be pregnant either. And because I didn't know how to be pregnant, again, I'd get loaded and I'd drink. And the more I drank and I used, the more I felt the babies, the more I felt that they were deformed or something had happened or, you know, to them. So the more I would drink and I would use just to not have to deal with the fact that I was pregnant. And so it just got really difficult for me, but I did have my baby, you know, and I'm so grateful for them today. There's some people in here that know my children, and they are a blessing. Like I said, there's not enough time for me to keep going on in regards to my history of my drinking and using, but I'd like to take you to the journey of my recovery. You know, because the recovery part of my life is what got me where I'm at today. You know, my bottom was a spiritual bottom. I'm like my mother, very suicidal drinker, user. I lost purpose way back in the day. Mentally, I believe I was gone a long time ago because of my choices and not having the capability of choosing from right to wrong, because I started drinking at a young age, you know. So mine was a spiritual bottom. I came into recovery on a blackout walk from after sticking a piece of mirror up my chin that I have a scar right here, right now, because I lost purpose. I lost purpose of why I was even here. And why did I lose purpose? Because my little brother Albert, AA, the seed was planted in my little brother Albert. And when Albert got out of prison, no, that's not true. When Albert came to the house, and he asked, told me he was going to court, and he wanted me to be there with him. I didn't know that that was the introduction to AA that he was doing to me. And he brought me to the Alano Club on Birch Street, and that's when I met Woody. And I remember I was so nervous because I was so sick, and I wanted a drink. I had drank all the way to morning, but I was already feeling sick, and I wanted to drink, and he's there talking to everyone, you know, talking to them, oh, I'm going to court, and I'm going to turn myself in, and all these things, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know, you can't turn yourself in. He goes, well, I'm going to turn myself in, and I'm going to go do my time, and I'm thinking, what's wrong with him, you know, and he's been talking all this stuff about, you know, being sober, and they're just kicking back. Everybody's just so calm, trying to hug me, you know. And, you know, I didn't want none of that either, you know. And Woody was, if you know Woody, Woody's very loud. And he reminded me of my brother, my older brother, and I couldn't stand him. He used to bring me, he used to scare the shit out of me, excuse my language. And I was so afraid of him, you know, and, but anyways, I had left, and my brother had called me, and he had told me that he had to cut me loose. Well, the only thing I know about cutting me loose is cutting me loose forever. And I found out that he was cutting me loose because he couldn't see me killing myself. Now these, I guess, AA fed him information that he couldn't be around me or whatever, I'm not sure. But when he did that, that was it. I felt, I lost the kid, you know, the kids were saved from me, from the system, you know, with CPS. I mean, you know, my mother no more, she was shunning me. Nobody wanted to be around me, and the only one I had left was Albert. And then you guys took him away from me. I hated you guys. I thought I was never ever going to see him again. And then it's... But I didn't know the seat was planted either when I walked into the alarm clock. You know, and I didn't know the seat was planted when he was talking to me and talking about AA. And I didn't even know that you had influenced my mother. You know, I didn't even know that's why my mom was shunning me. You know, that she wasn't practicing codependency anymore. You know, she was the one that was giving me the couple of bucks. You know, because I needed the drink, you know, I needed to get well, and she wasn't even doing that no more. She wasn't picking me up and taking me to the store. You know, she wasn't letting me see my kids, giving me the cot to sleep in because I needed the place to sleep anymore, giving me the meal because I was hungry. I was really not AA. And then, lo and behold, I had a spiritual bottom that led me to a different and he blessed me in Jesus. Timothy off. Then he led me to some women in recovery, which I'll always be grateful for. But they were hard assholes. You know? They had this saying, get out, you know? They sat me down and said, you're either going to do this or you're going to leave. You know what? Then they gave me coffee, and you're going to call. We're not going to call for you. And did you or die? Or, oh my God. And I'm sick, and I'm wanting to leave, and I'm saying, F them. You know, in my head, I'm not saying it loud, but I'm saying, F them. I'm too sick to say anything. And they're making me call these programs, and they're just there, you know, like being hard asses. And, oh, I just love them. I just love them. Who knew that God knew who, you know, I needed? So they watched over me. They didn't tie me down, and they didn't lock the door or anything. They just sat me in the chair, and they did what we call today the 12-step call, you know. And the thing is that's the miracle of one, and I thank them for that, because I was able to get into a program called Musicians, and little did I know that there was more white women there than there was Hispanic. Couldn't stand white people. But I was too sick. I was too sick. There was just no way that they put me in detox, and it amazed me how these women nurtured me 24/7 for the amount of time in detox, you know. And I don't know, that program, so much. But the women before that, you know, they were talking a lot of mumbo jumbo. I don't even know. I can't even say what they were saying, but they were saying what they needed to say, and it worked. You know, whatever it was, I stayed. And whatever the program did, I stayed. You know, and I remember when I went to my first meeting. Oh, there was this one counselor, I couldn't stand her with a passion, but she did me some good. I wanted to kick her ass in the alley, and it was like I was willing to go to jail for it. You know, and I had my little guppies, and I was feeding them, you know, with all kinds of little treats because I knew that's what they liked. You know, to defend me, and I found out that no, they weren't going to protect me. They were going to tell on me. You know, and it worked. It kept me in the program. That's how I got my sponsor, Sherry. I was really blessed with a wonderful man. That's been my sponsor for the past 22 years. Forever and ever, and always will be. This program taught me many things, you know. First things first, how to stay sober, you know. I had to admit that was a problem. You know, the serum was just the substance. I was the problem. I wasn't a loner, I always took people with me. You know, I always wanted a big party. Just so I could point all 10 fingers, you know. And then I was introduced to something, you know, I didn't know how to read or spell, you know, and I couldn't comprehend. I had a learning disability. You know, I had a comprehension problem. You know, I did a lot of glue, gas, paint. I did a lot of PCP. You know, I did everything. You know, a lot of drinking. It was like, I never thought my brain would ever clear up. It was like my body always shook inside, you know, and my eyes always shook inside. And it was like, I never thought that my shaking would ever stop, you know. And it was the only way that it would calm down is if I would drink, you know, and then it would calm down, you know. But they let me go through that stage, you know, of being sick and doing whatever, and they taught me. They taught me a lot of things of how to stay sober. Then I went to my first meeting, and then I come to this meeting. Oh my God, it's something I had never experienced before in my life. And it was like I go into this meeting and now everyone's kissing each other and hugging, and I'm going, oh my God. And I'm over here, you know, just saying, they better not touch me, and you know what, because I'm going to pop them, you know. And I remember, I know I'm breaking some anonymity, but what? Chew me out later. Rocking Mike. You know, he come one time and wanted to put his arm around me, and he was going to kiss me. I said, you put your lips on me, buddy, and I'm going to pop you. And he just, like, looked at me, and he said, okay, well, you're a newcomer, you know. You're a newcomer, you know. So anyways, I just love him dearly. And, but anyways, time ran, and, my sponsor showed me the way. The program showed me. There was a lot of women who nurtured me throughout the program. It was a short program, but I extended my stay. There were some restrictions that was given to me. I couldn't go back to my mom. My mom was doing her thing. She had the kids, and I had to choose a new way of living. And I only knew one skill: walk the street, make money, and steal and feed and do whatever I had to do just so I can get well. And work in packing houses and do all that, and I found out that, you know, there's just not that in the world, you know. So my sponsor taught me a lot, and she worked with me a lot, and she explained a lot. I wanted what she had. Well, there was one woman before her that I wanted what she had, and it seemed like she had some buckaroos, but it didn't work out for me, you know. God seemed fit that I have my sponsor now, and the big bucks wasn't what I needed, even though it's what I perceived it to be. What I needed was love and compassion, and I needed guidance. I met a lot of good people in this program. I learned every year. It's never an ending. There's not a destination. It's something that I would treasure for my life churches until I end up in heaven. I have a God of my understanding, thanks to Father Fred, that he introduced me to a God, good early direction that led me to a spiritual concept, because I had a bad concept of what God was about. And little did I know that I was practicing it to the best of my ability, you know, to live a spiritual way of life, you know, not drinking, you know, not treating people the way I treated them, you know, and working on it, some issues, because I wasn't willing enough to work on other issues, and some character defects that were still working, I wasn't willing to surrender those yet either. And but I did. I ended up surrendering to a power greater than me, you know. And at first it was the power of AA. It was the people I hated most that I depended on to keep me sober. So get that, you know. And the people in AA, it don't matter if you're a newcomer, I love you anyway. I don't even have to know your name, and I love you unconditionally anyway. Because it is you that guided me to this point. We are all trying to get better. When I did my inventory with my sponsor, I didn't know I was a good person. She identified it to me that I just had some problems. I could filter those out and look at who I've become. I could be the person that I was always to be, you know. There's no regrets. You know, it was a plan made for me to come to a point of accepting me for who I am, you know. And when I did that, the first thing I needed to do was make amends to me, you know, for being so afraid just to be me, you know. I'm a very humble person, or I try to be humble. There's times I still get in my other kind of shoes, you know, and want to be a badass, but I'm not, you know. I catch myself more often now, you know, and I'm not afraid to admit. I love the feeling of being humble. You know, I like the fact that I still have the ability to sense or feel humility, you know, because otherwise I wouldn't still be here in AA. You know, I'd be thinking I have it all together, you know. I've had so much wonderful experiences. I've been to college. I've been stable in employment. Places where I would never be by the thanks of another dear friend of mine that believed in me when I couldn't believe in myself and took me from this and put me in this and made whatever it was come true, you know. And it has benefited not only me, you know, but it's benefited other people like me, that if I could do it, you can do it. You know, all you need is for somebody. And you know, they used to have a saying, you know, and I remember the saying, he said, if you don't believe, believe that we do. And I believe that, because people believed in me when I couldn't. And people loved me when I couldn't. I didn't have a problem hating me. I had a problem loving me, you know. And this God, you know, that, or this higher power, who I choose to call God, you know, who speaks through spirit, which comes out of your people's mouth, that tells me I'm okay. I'm okay up here today. You know, I'm okay being open to you, you know. I give you permission to take with you my message. I have nothing that's going to hinder me. You know, that whatever it is that you, that I shared with you, that you feel that's going to benefit you out there, take it with you and do as I will with it. Because it's coming from my heart. Because I prayed before I shared. I'm not afraid. You know, this program gave me that. I love this program. It tells me I'm not perfect. It tells me I'm human. It tells me I am the seven deadly sins. It tells me I have to be an action. It tells me I have to have a sponsor. It tells me I have to be in service. It tells me I have to be there for others. But most of all, it tells me I have to pray. And I have to believe, you know. There's a lot of things that this program has given me. I have been blessed with my children, The children I lost my parental rights to. These things don't happen. At 2.5 years, I get my children returned to me. After 10 years of not having them. Now, what else could give you something like that when you feel that you're not that deserving? I have 5 grandchildren now. They're 33 and 31 now, my children. I have a wonderful husband. People in here know that I went through some relationship issues when I was in this, at the beginning, but I didn't follow the rule. When you don't follow the rule, you try to fit a piece of puzzle where it don't belong, boy, it gets pretty rigid, you know. But when ready, God blessed me with a companion, and he knows that I love somebody more than him. He's big, he's bad, and he'll kick his ass if he does me anything. And that's God. And he knew that from the very beginning. I've been with him for 19 years. And he's been a good father to my children. He did for my children what I didn't have healing. You know. He parented my kids and nurtured them what they needed. A father figure, you know. He was calm when I wasn't. You know, I'm still learning to be the calm mother, you know. But anyways, my husband, yes, we ride a bike. I'm a packer, okay. But the thing is, someday, okay, I've compromised. I said, okay, I'll get a trike, okay. He doesn't want me on a two-wheel bike, you know, so. I'm just gonna, you know, and the thing is that he's taking me to places. Recovery, one of the things about recovery is there's a lot of fun in recovery, you know. Once you give it a chance, I've been to places where I would have never gone in recovery. I've celebrated with people everywhere. You know, there's recovering people everywhere. AA's everywhere, all the way to Morelia, Mexico, we've been traveling everywhere, and I'm telling, you know, AA's everywhere, you know, and I love bikers today, yes, I do, and, you know, I mean, I just love people today, and life is just fun. I still go through my fears, you know, I still go through some hardships. You know, I just live life on life terms, as they say. You know, sometimes it's baby steps, sometimes it's big steps, sometimes there's no steps at all. You know, the true thing, and when you get recovery, you get complacent a lot of the times, and you forget. And I'll tell you, when you're in service, you don't forget because you got to keep busy. You know. Your sponsees will keep you in check, you know, and so it's about being in service, it's about going to meetings, it's about admitting, you know, that you're not perfect. It's about, you know, life is not perfect. It's not meant to be perfect. There's only one perfect, you know, and it's just learning skills to cope, you know. Alcohol, I'm not going to deny with my friends for a long, long, long time until it stopped working. I didn't know it was going to backstab me, you know. It was my friend for a long time. And if I let it, it'll come right back. I have to keep the door closed. And I have to come to a place of protection. And that's AA. And with that, I'll keep coming back.